I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and it's not a great way to start, but I'm going to begin by asking you to turn your telephones off. Telephones. Oh, God, I just dated myself there, didn't I? Cell phones. Okay, everybody's taking care of that. We'll move on. I want to first remind everybody, mark your calendars. We are off next week for spring break. I hope that, you're always welcome to come. The galleries stay open even when the Tuesday evening doesn't happen for the run of the program. So you could come and have a little extra time in the galleries. But we won't have any Tuesday evening lecture next week in honor of spring break. But I do want you to remind you to be back the following Tuesday, March 22nd, with the spectacular Mary Ellen Carroll. I hope you've looked into her work or are already familiar with her work. I think she's going to definitely be a memorable lecture. Her most recent project, I hope I get this right because I didn't write it down, but she's taken an entire property and turned it 360 degrees in Houston. I mean, lawn and everything. So she thinks big, and I think it's going to be a night to remember. So I invite you back for the 22nd. And in the meantime, there is going to be the Sundays with the Modern Tour at 1 p.m. this coming Sunday. We have with us this week architect Greg Abanez, and I don't know for sure what Greg is going to focus on, but I assume that it will be some aspect of the architecture or perhaps the art within the architecture and that relationship. These tours have been very interesting in the unique, varied, and informed insights that they provide from week to week. So I invite you to come back or to come on Sunday for that. I think that tour will probably meet at the information desk since there's no designated area, other designated area. And of course, those are free with the cost of admission. If you're a member, it's free altogether. Tonight we have artist Kristen Morgan here from LA, where she, after having taught for a period, now works solely in her studio on sculptures comprised primarily of fired and unfired clay that replicate true to scale objects. The work is represented in LA by Mark Zellwin Gallery and in New York by Zach Fuhrer Gallery. Kristen has lived most of her life in California, basically leaving, the best I can tell, only for graduate school in New York, where she received an MFA from Alfred University School of Ceramics in 1997. She was recently back in New York City, however, where she opened the Zach Fuhrer's new location in Chelsea with the inaugural exhibition, New York Be Nice, which is a title I love. Other recent solo exhibitions include Cellos and Objects for Everyone I Have Known, another title I love and am very curious about. Both of those exhibitions were at the Mark Zellwin Gallery. And then there also is the exhibition formerly known as Passengers 2.7, which was at the CCA Watts Institute for Contemporary Art in San Francisco. And this is just naming a very few of the long list of solo exhibitions in Kristen's career. Kristen's work was featured in Unmonumental at the New Museum in New York. Again, that was the inaugural exhibition for that space as well. She was also in Thing at UCLA, Hammer Museum of Los Angeles, Red Eye at the Rubel Family Collection in Miami, and currently Huckleberry Finn, again at the CCA Watts Institute for Contemporary Art in San Francisco. In the Zach Fuhrer press release, Kristen's work is described as capturing the complexity of the present by way of the past. The corroding surfaces of her objects not only capture the here and now, but project fragility, mortality, and decay. And more specifically, LA Times art critic Christopher Knight has written, "Melancholy does not merely waft into the atmosphere from Kristen Morgan's elaborately crafted clay, wire, and wood sculptures. It pours forth in torrents, filling the gallery with sadness that is palpable, almost unbearable." I guess we can judge for ourselves tonight as Kristen shares her work and ideas. And from the glimpse that I got earlier of the slides, I think possibly a little bit of her life as well. And since I got that glimpse, I've been very curious and very anxious to hear this presentation. So will you please join me in welcoming Kristen Morgan?
Hi. You can lower the lights. Who's ever lowering the lights? Okay. I like to talk about a lot of things that I like to look at, things that I think have to do with my work, and some things that I've paid attention to for a long, long time, and I think they have to do with my work, but I'm not really able to pinpoint what exactly. But the slide closest to me is, that's my family. Some of my works have to do with my family, but mostly they're just really sweet people, and they've always supported me and been very big fans. So I like to give them a shout out. I'm the oldest daughter of four girls, and I grew up in Northern California in San Jose for most of my life. I lived there. Now I currently live in Southern California. The picture furthest from me is a picture I found in a book a long, long time ago. There are only a few scraps of information I can remember about the photograph, and one is that it is a film still from a very old movie, but the title of the movie I don't know. And the other bit of information I know about this photograph is that the baby in the photograph grew up to be a director of horror films. And this photograph has always really appealed to me because the supposed horror of an infant being carried off by a giant bird is equally as horrific as an infant being carried off by a janky stage prop. And I like the fact that it's equally horrible no matter how you look at it. So. I have no idea who these people are. This is something that I do. I go to estate sales and I collect these slides of people who had no further use for their slide collections. The picture closest to me is a very early drawing that I did maybe around 1976 with color crayon, and it was based on a painting that I saw in Spain. My father, he was a chemist, and he was sent on a business trip to Spain, and he took the whole family with him to Spain, and for the first time in my life I saw all of this art, and I was completely captivated with Francisco Goya, and I wanted to grow up to become a painter. And so this was like a first attempt at painting. In this other photograph, that's a photograph of me and my best friend Michael Ress. I'm dressed as Jill from Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill, and Mike is dressed as the mouse from Hickory Dickory Dock, and it was the nursery rhyme day parade at kindergarten, and I am really, really, really sick. I have like 104 temperature, and this was all, there were months before this parade that I was getting ready for it, collecting Band-Aids and whatnot, and then I got, like, painfully ill. And this was a common occurrence when I was a child. I was chronically sick all the time. And but one thing that it did do is, it's because I was, bedridden, it sort of, it, it sort of heightened my skills for being observant, because I couldn't always participate in things, and so and it also just enriched, you know, certain skills. I had spent a lot more time drawing and observing than I could, you know, playing like other children. Because I was also an invalid, I spent a lot of time watching television. And my father was, he was a chemist, but he was raised on really awful science fiction movies and sort of like drilled them into us. And I was very receptive, and I really fell in love with horror films and at a very young age. This is Boris Karloff in Frankenstein, and you will find a lot of themes within horror films sort of peppered throughout my work. I also had this idea when I was a kid that all black and white films were of horror film kind of genre. I knew horror films came in color, but I was certain that all black and white films were definitely horror films. And so I ended up watching a lot of black and white films that were not horror films and would constantly be disappointed by this. But also I discovered, you know, there were actresses like Bette Davis here, and she would trick me a lot because she could be really horrifying. But I developed a kind of love for these other actresses and actors of the silver screen. And especially people like Bette Davis and Greta Garbo and Judy Garland, they were these people that sort of were able to outlive their own legendary status and became these really steely, tough people that, you know, you couldn't really knock down. This is a place that I visited. It's the House on the Rock. It's in Wisconsin, and it's the home of the world's largest carousel. There's some, I don't know, it's two stories and some 80,000 lights on it, and I don't know, 200 different animals. Not a single one of them is a horse. And this place was created by this man who was kind of a collector, but quite an eccentric man who built this home on top of a 50-foot rock above the forest in Wisconsin. And he just went out and started collecting things that he enjoyed to draw people to this home. And every time he collected things, he would add a new wing onto this house. And at some point, he built this three-story tall sea beast being attacked by a giant squid. And it's surrounded by models of every conceivable boat or ship that you can imagine. It's a really incredible place. These vehicles are photographs that I took on a trip to Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty. And I was actually more intrigued with this junk when I was out there than, well, the Spiral Jetty is beautiful. If you ever get an opportunity to go out there, it's a very eerie, strange, wonderful place. And this junk is no longer there, and I just totally fell in love with it. But it's been taken away by the state, but someday I want to make these things too, I think, if I have another couple of cars in me. These are photographs from one of my very favorite places in Los Angeles. It's no longer there. It's closed around 2005, and this is the Movieland Wax Museum. And this place was truly incredible in that it was huge, and it had every movie from Laurel and Hardy all the way up to more contemporary things with Britney Spears and Michael Jackson, and all these different movies. There was John Travolta, but every movie would come with its own sort of tableau, a set to look like the movie. And one of my favorite things was that they would take, they would retire certain things. So once in a while, you would come across, you know, a very odd tableau that was, everything in it was sort of taken out of context. You would have Batman on the set of a farmhouse on a Harley Davidson, and you didn't know why anything was there. So it was a really magical place. This is kind of a gruesome thing, and I know it has to do with my work, but I'm not really sure what. But this is a photograph. There's this baby, and he died around 1952. And it was a time when people no longer really photographed their dead children. And if your child died in 1952, it was kind of a shock and a very upsetting thing. But the thing that I love about this is that the parents really wanted to sort of reclaim something from this horrible event. And so they photographed the baby in his casket, and then they photographed him again, but they, it's hard to tell, but they pasted photographs of open eyes over his closed eyes so that they could remember what he looked like when he was alive. And so... on a lighter note, this was one of my teachers, and he, this man is named Clayton Bailey, and he was known for a lot of different things, but one of the things he became very well known for was, he used to say that he liked the idea of hunting for dinosaurs, but he didn't like to travel. So he decided to make his own, and he built this enormous skeleton and buried it in his backyard. And then it rained, and he went out into the backyard, and he invented a pseudonym for himself. He said he was Dr. Gladstone, and he said that he had recovered the remains of a Bigfoot. And he went all over the country giving lectures on his Bigfoot finds, and he told you exactly how you could go out yourself and find your own Bigfoot remains. And he invented this pseudo-scientific language where he said he had found the Chaolithic remains of the pre-credulous era of Bigfoot. And, you know, and he gave these very intense, very long lectures, and eventually he made so many remains that he opened his own museum that was called the Museum of Unnatural History. And for a quarter, you could take tours of it. But the one thing that he told me was that there was a time and place for a practical joke, and fine art is a really great place for a practical joke because absolutely nobody expects it. So, I'm totally in love with the dodo bird. This particular animal went extinct within 80 years of its discovery and extinction. It was discovered, and then 80 years later, it was totally wiped off the planet. And it was discovered at a time when natural history museums were really in their infancy. And the way that they would collect specimens, they'd just go out and get one and stuff it, and then moths would eat it, and they'd throw it away, and they'd go out and get another one. They went out to find another specimen from the dodo bird because it had been thrown away, and there were no dodo birds left. And so all of our imagery, all of our ideas of what this animal looked like are completely fictitious. And that's one thing I really like about this animal, is that we have this idea that we know what this animal looks like, but we really don't. So this is like a quick overview of different pieces that I've made, and just to give you different ideas of different things that I've made. These are two cars. The car closest to me was based on several different years of Cadillac. And it's all made out of unfired clay that is glued essentially to wood and wire armature. And this other car is kind of based on a child's pedal car. I had just seen Bonnie and Clyde's Model T Ford that they were gunned down in, and I was totally infatuated with this car, and I wanted to make like a junior version of it. I also do really ridiculous things like this. These are play sets. So closest to me is Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet on the Titanic. And then furthest from me is the Goya's Third of May play set. These are all fired and glazed ceramics. And I do take these things really seriously. I like what happens when you place them next to this other type of work that I do. I find that I kind of repeat myself about every 7 years. And so these are cups, and these were made about 10 years apart. The cup closest to me, it was made out of, there's like a wire frame, and clay is glued to the wire, and then it's sort of, there's paint and paper and collage. This idea of collage comes up a lot in my work. And then furthest from me are cups that are fired and glazed, and I made all the drawings myself, but I do a lot of drawing on top of my drawing. Again, it's kind of like collage, but I'm making all of the collage aspects. These are two different photographs of my studios, two different studios that I held about 10 years apart. And this, you know, kind of chaos is something that I have quite often in my studio. These are very recent works that I've made, and I'm kind of really interested in this idea of a still life and these objects that are sort of placed together that might be really taken out of context, but that get a new context when you put them all together. So this piece is called 150 Ways to Play Solitaire, and there's a book here that's got the same title. These things are also all made out of unfired clay that has been painted. There's not a book or anything of the sort in the still life. This is a table. It's a fairly large table. It's called the repeating table. And the idea here is, I was kind of going off this idea that history sort of repeats itself. And so on, ooh, I love this pointer thing. So on this side of the table, these are all actual books and toys and cigarette boxes and things like that. On this side of the table, I have made all of these objects, but out of unfired clay and paint. So the idea is that history sort of repeats itself. I'm interested in remaking these objects as a kind of tributary thing, but in the end, both things are utterly doomed. You know, the paper things will disintegrate, and so will my tributes. They're essentially painted dirt. These are also more recent pieces, and I've been doing a lot of this sort of drawing on top of things. And so there's a giant squid here and a Tweety bird, and I think there's a Walt Disney little blue bird here, and there's some Smurfs over here and a mean Donald Duck. I take a lot of my imagery from warplanes and comics and also fine art as well. You'll find Giotto and Philip Guston sort of laced throughout these things. In this far piece, there is a dodo bird drawn right there. It's kind of hard to see, but it's on all of the comic books. Again, the comic books are all unfired clay that has been painted. These two pieces, these two horses, went together. And again, there's a lot more sort of drawing on the surface that really interrupts the form, but also informs it and gives it this other wider sort of context. I like to make cars, and this is my most recent car. James Dean was killed in 1955 in this Porsche Spyder, and the car that he died in was rumored to be cursed. And after he died in this car, parts of the car were put in other cars, and those cars also had fatal or near fatal accidents with the drivers of those cars. And then at some point, you know, these accidents had happened so often that the owner of the car sold the wreck to the highway patrol. And the highway patrol put the car on display all over the country to sort of promote highway safety. And at some point, the car was being driven on a truck back from Florida to LA, and the pink slip showed up, but the car was gone and was never to be heard of again. And so my idea at this time was to make a car that was really had no business being on the planet, and to kind of bring it back. Maybe not such a good idea. About midway through, I decided I really didn't want to make it, but I kind of had to. And so this car consequently took me about 6 months to build. And but I did really like the way it turned out. But I'm glad it's over with. So all this unfired clay is fairly unconventional for ceramics. Usually for something technically to be ceramics, it has to be fired in a kiln. And I first started making this work when I was in graduate school in a very unlikely place at a very traditional graduate school. Known as Alfred. Alfred is, you know, a kind of mecca for ceramics, and they want you to glaze and fire things. So when you say in the middle of your first semester that you don't want to fire things, you're asking for trouble. And so, but that's what I did, and it started with this piece. This has, like, there's a violin in there. It's sometimes hard to see. But I made it, and I had intended to fire it, but it just sort of sat around in my studio. And I wanted it to kind of look like this music that I was listening to, particular pieces of violin music. And I thought that it was this very fleeting thing, and it sort of made sense that it should be this very fragile work of art, that it should look fragile and that it should be fragile. So I left it, and I continued making these objects that looked fragile. And the fragility kind of gave the work a mortality that artworks have. You know, like if you put a painting out in the rain, it will go bad. But it's really very evident on the sleeves of this work. It's very apparent that it's very fragile, and people get very squeamish about it, owning it. So, these are some places that I visited and that I inhabited when I was in graduate school. This is my studio, and I was known as the girl with the messy studio, and actually this floor is a false floor. I had built up about a foot of rubble on my floor, and every time my faculty would speak to me about my work, we would talk about the mess in my studio and not really so much about my work. And so I really wanted them to kind of see my work, so I just built a false floor over the existing rubble. I felt like I needed the rubble. I couldn't throw it away, so I just built a level over the top of it. This picture over here, this is from a health spa, an abandoned health spa that I used to visit when I was in graduate school. This is another picture from the health spa. It was about 5 stories tall, and it was first opened in the 1850s by a guy named Bernard McFadden. And he was a contemporary of Kellogg and believed that if you could go there and on a regiment of exercise and enemas, and you could lose weight and vacation. It was a very beautiful place. I really love those places. And this is an abandoned mercury mine that I used to trespass on, and also used to inform my work quite a bit. About a year after graduate school, I was invited to be a visiting artist at Cal State Long Beach. And I was there for just one summer, and I built a ton of work, but really one of the more important things that I made was this piano. When I was in school, it was a really hard thing to justify why I was making all this work out of unfired clay. I just didn't have a very recipient audience. So when I got out of school, I was very excited to make all this work out of all this mixed material. So this is plaster and clay and wood and wire and string and all these materials that I could get my hands on. And also it was a fairly large work. And I could just see that it was possible for me to make things on a larger scale. So these next works I made around the year 2001. And that was a very difficult year for me. A very close friend of mine had died, and I really had never had anybody die close to me. And so my way of dealing with it was just to work nonstop. And I made a literal ton of work. I was interested in seeing ghosts because I had this friend die. And sometimes for me, my artwork is obtaining things that I can't have. So I really wanted to see a ghost. I didn't see any ghosts, so I made some. And these are collages of ghosts that I made. These are some other paper collages. I made about 100 of them, and then under a misfortune, they were all stolen. And so then I made about 150 of them and put them in this. I had this one large solo show that these works were part of. I also began making these series of cups and teapots. Ceramics has this tradition in cups and teapots and domestic ware, and I wanted to sort of give it my chance, you know, and try to make these shapes. And so, again, it's just wire and clay that is sort of stuck to the wire, and I think I treated it with paint and various things that I would set on fire, and then paper collage is introduced as well. And I like the way that they were kind of a set for a stage, and the inside of these vessels was where all the action was happening. There were about 60 to 70 sculptures in the show, as well as 150 paper collages. And these were some of the sculptures. I had this idea that I was going to tie it all together somehow, but I didn't really know how until sometime towards the end. I just thought of this title, and I called it The Ticking Elephant and Other Surviving Excerpts of the Hope Symphony. And this became this total fiction that I invented and that I passed off as the truth as at the time. I told this very long, lengthy story about the Hope Symphony and who wrote it. And I had 9 cellos and several violins and other musical instruments, as well as objects. And it was all supposed to be part of this very large, very ridiculous, very long-lived symphony that never got heard. This is the star of the show. This is the ticking elephant, and he did tick on a little pin. So this was an enormous amount of work, and but I wasn't finished yet. So around this time, a good friend of mine called me, and he was a graduate student at the time. And he said, "I'm really tired of people talking to me. Would you just come here and make something with me?" And so I said, "Okay." And so I went, and we took a ton of clay and made it look like this baby elephant. To give you an idea of scale, this here is a cinder block that its leg is resting on. So, I mean, it's huge. We broke it up, and we did actually fire it to bisque. But again, it was just sort of informing me that these larger-than-life big things were possible with this very delicate material. Around this time, I knew that a few months after I'd made this elephant, I was going to have to go to Kansas City. And I thought I would bring that elephant, but these other things started to cloud my imagination. This is a cardboard car on Santa Monica Boulevard, and it's a BMW of the 300 series, and it was made by this artist by the name of David Poulin. He was really influenced by James Bond movies. He wanted to be like James Bond, but he didn't have very much money. So he decided that he would make his own James Bond kind of lifestyle, but do it on a shoestring kind of budget. So he started by making these cardboard cars, and they were all BMWs, and he just kind of started with the car and thought it would become more spyware, but then he just decided he needed to build all of the 300 series of BMW. And then he had this fleet of cars, and without much to do with them, he took them out into Santa Monica and Los Angeles and La Jolla and San Diego and Watts, and he parked them. And he parked them in very clever spots, like no parking zones, and he got on the news and everything. And it was very clever, and I really adored these cars. I was also at the time thinking about these Cadillacs. This is the 1959 Cadillac. And I was interested in the fact that Cadillac had kind of been demoted as a symbol of your status. Your highest status wasn't reached anymore if you had an Escalade. But in 1959, if you had one of these cars, you were really something very special. And they kind of seems so majestic and like trying to navigate around the world in the body of a blue whale or something like that. They were just so enormous. And so this idea sort of grew in my mind, and I decided, what the hell, I'll build a Cadillac. And I didn't know anything about Cadillac, and as you can tell, it kind of changes year as you go towards the back of the Cadillac. But it was built in pieces, and I built it in about a month. And I think I was just trying to see if I could do this. I had lots of colleagues who were telling me, you can't build something that big and that fragile and ever hope to work with a commercial gallery, and you can't ever hope to take these things and have shows in places other than Los Angeles. It's just too far to bring these things. So I built this, again, like I said, in a month, and then I moved it to Kansas City, where it was in a show. And it's still in Kansas City, I think. The owner of the building said he would keep it until I found a better home for it. So, But I kind of really thought that it would get me a lot of notoriety. I mean, it's a Cadillac made out of unfired clay and cement, and it looks really cool, and it's this really visceral thing, and it wasn't so much as mentioned in the review of the show, and I kind of was really sort of crushed by the whole incident. So I decided I wasn't going to make any more sculptures for a while. And so for about a year, I just kind of moped around in a kind of rut. But looking back on it now, I don't think it was a rut so much as I was just really tired. I had made a lot of work that year, and I had suffered a lot of loss, and I think I just wanted a break. But I felt at some point in that year that I needed a hobby, and I woke up one morning and I desperately needed to play the accordion. I had never played a musical instrument in my life, but I really, really wanted to play the accordion. So I went out, and with the help of some friends, I found an accordion and obsessively played it. My grandfather, who was a musician, would give me lessons over the phone, and I got as far as learning how to play half of La Vie en Rose and about a whole page of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. And I loved this accordion so much that I kind of got back into making sculpture by making this version of my accordion, but I made it entirely out of playing cards. This is also something cool. This is my apartment at the time, and these are the 9 cellos that I had made for my show, stacked up in crates. Those cellos stayed with me for about 10 years, and they weren't shown or seen until about a year ago, and then they were all shown in one big show. About a year or so after I took up the accordion, I got a phone call and somebody said that they saw my car, and I was really excited. And they said, yeah, we want you to come to Denver and be in this show. It was actually in Boulder. And it was called Because the Earth is One-Third Dirt. And it was a big survey show about ceramics, and there were very refined, fired and glazed ceramics in this show, as well as unrefined ceramics in this show. At the time, I had come home from Italy, and I fell in love with these little cars. This is like the Italian version of the SUV. About every single Italian you ever talked to learned to drive in one of these cars and almost lost their life in one at some point. About 9 people can sit in them. About 2 people can lift them. They can drive over incredible terrain. They're incredibly capable pieces of engineering. So I kind of was interested in these cars because of all of their abilities. And I built this version of these little cars, and I wanted to couple it with another car. But about this time, I had read this description of a piano that Beethoven had owned, and I thought it would be a better pairing to pair this silly little car with this very elegant piano. Beethoven's actual piano is in much better shape than mine, but it does exist, and I think it's in a museum in Brussels somewhere or something like that. But I like the coupling of them. And they were shown together as a couple and then shown many other times after that separately. The little car went as far as Korea and back. And eventually both pieces were bought up by the Hammer Museum. And so I like the fact that they're now a couple again. This is sort of a how-to. This is me building a car. And it starts with this sort of jungle of sticks that I staple wire to, and then this is a bucket of dry cement, and this is a bowl of glue, and there was another bucket over here of slop, like clay, and my hand would go in this sloppy clay, and then it would get rolled around in the bucket of cement, and then get plopped in the glue and then stuck to this wood and the wire. And then I just made it look like a car. And this car was the largest car I'd ever built. It was the second Cadillac I ever made, and it was based on a Cadillac hearse. So many people talked about how my work was about death, and I really kind of saw it as really a defiance of death. These things really shouldn't be in existence, but yet they're there. So I wanted to take something that was really pregnant with death, like a hearse, and try and make it and see what happened. I really love the Guinness Book of World Records, and the world's largest bobblehead is Chuck Woolery. I'm really fascinated with what they put in this book. I don't know how you get in, but it's usually the largest or the most priciest. This is a place, okay, this is in Spillville, Iowa, and there is nothing in Spillville, Iowa except for this place. And this place is known for two fairly remarkable things. One, that this building is where Anton Dvorak came and summered for a few months in the summer and fell in love with America and began writing the New World Symphony in this building. The other thing that this building and the town is actually well known for are these two brothers. They were the Billy brothers, and they lived together their entire lives. They didn't travel more than 30 miles away from their home. And they were farmers, and in the off months when they weren't farming, they would carve and design these very incredible clocks. They had all these moving parts and little dancing figures, and at some point towards the end of the brothers' lives, they decided they were getting old in age, and they didn't have anybody to leave the clocks to, so they would burn them all. And the mayor of the town begged them to keep the clocks, and they said, "You can keep the clocks, but you can never let them leave this town, and they'll always have to stay. They can't be separated, and so you can go to the middle of nowhere to Spillville, Iowa, and visit this little building, which on the upstairs is like dedicated to Dvorak, and on the downstairs are all the clocks that the Billy brothers had made." This is also a place that I visited, and it's called the Grotto of the Redemption. It was built by a priest, and it is the world's largest concentration of precious stones and gemstones and petrified rock. And he spent 10 years alone just acquiring all these rocks. He would get them put on the railroad and brought into the town by train. And he built this enormous sort of pavilion of 8 different grottos, completely encrusted with rocks and gemstones and geodes. And it was all kind of like this shrine to the Virgin Mary, who saved his life from pneumonia. The picture closest to me is one of my good friends who filled her car with a false forest made out of car fresheners. And this is cave formations in the caves in the Black Hills near Mount Rushmore. These are also some things that I really love looking at. This is an artist, I forget his name, but he lives in South Africa and reads these contemporary stories, American stories, and then paints them, these narratives. So this one was about O.J. Simpson. And this is Henry Darger, who is one of my heroes. These are some other examples of folk art that I've always loved to look at. I put a lot of these in there. Okay, so these are some cars that I've liked. This car is completely mosaiced with cigarette butts. And this is a modified motorcycle that was turned into a motorhome that I saw. And on the back it says, it's hell without Jesus. I really love that. This is a lowrider, and lowriders are very well known in Los Angeles, and I've never really liked cars. I don't like driving, and I think I initially started making cars to try to come to terms with having to live alongside of car culture. I always had to live next to it, and so I wanted to understand it more deeply. And lowriders, particularly this one, is really spectacular in its story. This is kind of like a classic Impala lowrider, and the owner made it look like this, and then it was sideswiped in an accident, and then the owner took the wreck and made it look like this a second time. And I really love that kind of love and devotion to something. So this is my idea of a lowrider, and it is based on a 4951 Mercury. It's the same year of Mercury that James Dean drove around in the movie Rebel Without a Cause. And if ever you're going to see a lowrider with flames on it, this would be your car. Or if ever you'd see one that's chopped and lowered, this is also your car. There were names of my friends and family on the inside of it. And I kind of dedicated it to my family and my loved ones. About this time, I was becoming a little more well-known than I was before. And I was becoming known as the girl who makes the clay cars. And I wanted to quickly rid myself of that reputation. So I decided that I would make this carousel. And I started making these carousel animals. And I didn't know what I was going to put exactly on this carousel, but I needed Popeye and Mighty Mouse on it for whatever reason, and I had these horses. And then I put all this work in a show, and I sold everything. And I kind of had all the wind sort of taken out of my sails, and I didn't want to make this piece anymore. I was on a sabbatical, and I needed to figure out something else to make. So I turned to the first thing that was next to me, and it was a Monopoly game. And at first I was really interested in the idea of Monopoly being this sort of mass-produced thing that I was going to make by hand. And I did make it by hand. I made like every little line on these cards. And turns out there's an awful lot of cards in the Monopoly game. And it took me almost a year sort of on and off making this thing. And when I got finished with it, it really seemed to be kind of like penance for feeling bad having sold all my work. But I liked the implications that this thing had. And also this new scale. It was really small, and I liked that sort of dainty scale. And these works were more fragile than ever. They were just very thin pieces of clay that had a thin layer of paint on it, with drawn on, sometimes with marker that would also fade. And that sort of piqued my interest even more. About this time, I was also I was a smoker for about 20 years, and I love cigarettes. I would smoke them today if I could, but I was getting sick, and I had to quit smoking. And when you quit smoking, you get a lot of time added on to your day. So I also had to stop doing all the things that I did with smoking. So coffee, I could only really have one cup a day. And so I thought if I would only have one cup a day, I would make the cup that it came out of. I had all this extra time. So I started making these cups, and I really sort of fell in love with these very emotive cartoon characters. That this is exactly how I felt. So also at this time, my youngest sister got married and asked me to make the wedding favors for all the people at her wedding. And so I made 250 of these small cups, and I really loved the sort of collage that would happen with them. And so I wanted to investigate that further. I still wanted to smoke, of course, because you can't just make 250 cups and expect that you won't want to smoke. So I started to make these boxes of cigarettes, and also, again, with the cartoon characters, you know, this very deep, exaggerated emotion was really important to me. But then I really liked the cartoon characters, so I decided to just make the cartoons. And these were made by, it's painted clay, and they were meant to be a kind of tribute to these things that I loved. And for me, I got to spend time with these things that I knew I already really just loved. And I would do this sort of drawing on top of my drawing. So again, there's a dodo bird in there, and Alice in Wonderland is over here. There's a little Kilroy was here down there, and various ghosts and things in there. I looked around my home, you know, as far as things that I kept, and I kept these ridiculous things. I had these cups. This was a pair of cups originally, and one of them broke. So I made the one that broke, but I made it out of unfired clay and paint and marker. This one was a cup that broke, and I repaired the cup with unfired clay and marker. Again, the repair is probably more unstable than the remaining bit. I kept a lot of books and magazines, and I don't really know why. I don't really like to read that much, but I decided to make these things and just spend more time with them. I think I really like to look at the pictures a lot. So I just tried my very hardest to try to make this thing, and then I would show them with the original object, and they kind of became like old couples sometimes that would complete one another's sentence and sort of be inseparable. Sometimes they were very combative and they didn't really like one another. And I liked these relationships that would happen. Again, you know, I'm looking around at things that I just like, and I'm tired of coming up with trying to make new things that I might like, and I just kind of want to start with something that I know I like. So again, I did a lot of overdrawing. So down here is The Death of St. Francis by Giotto, and this is Philip Guston's finger, and this is a little wing. And it's kind of like everybody's paying attention to poor St. Francis down there. This is a giant squid attacking Sam I Am, and this is Harold and his purple crayon, and I think there's the purple moon. So I like all these references. Sometimes when I would really try hard to make things, I couldn't. You know, it was just too small to make these two gun hands. So I substituted Droopy Dog and Quick Draw McGraw. This is a situation here where I exchanged comic books. So this is from like a war comic book, and this is from a romance comic book. And then I would doodle over the top. She's got horns and he's got wings. At around this time, I had this experience where I was in traffic And I inadvertently cut somebody off. And I'm not a very good driver, as I've said. I don't like driving. And somebody got very upset with me and flipped me off and then sped past me. And I thought that, okay, this is my one and only experience with this person, and there it went, and he flipped me off, and that's all. And I just kind of thought that I wanted to try to do something nice for my fellow man, so I began this project where I was starting to make objects for everybody I'd ever known. And these are some things that I made for colleagues of mine that I worked with at the school that I taught at for that time. I honestly did make these things for people, and then I gave them to them. And at some point, I got a big collection of them together, and I put them all into a show that was called Objects for Everybody I'd Ever Known. I put them on these huge tables, and it was kind of like a big, pathetic garage sale. Underneath the table are all these things that sort of inspired the things on the table. Some of these things on the table were sold. Some of them I kept. Some of them were given away to people I had made them for. So I like the fact that this thing was only going to be seen in this way one time. But it totally spun my work in a different direction. These are some of my favorite comic books that came out of that series. This one's called Bela Lugosi Was Here, and he's right there, if you can see him. These are some other... This one, it was an object that I made for a colleague of mine. And this is Candyland that I made. It was sold. And these are my very last slides. One of them was sold and one of them was given away. But this one, I tried to fit 100 Caspers in it. So it's kind of based on, like in the 1970s, there was these children's magazines called Highlights, where you'd, what's in this picture, you know? And so I hid 100 Caspers in this comic book. And that's the end of my show. Thank you. It's 8 o'clock, but you can ask questions if you want. Yes?
How have you managed storing your inventory of work?
While I was teaching, I did I didn't work with commercial galleries until more recently, and so I did want to keep everything that I made, and... So while I was teaching, it provided a paycheck for me to have at least storage space. And so there were a lot of things that were in storage for a long time, and things that I kept in garages. And right now I do have two of those large cars. I own the hearse and I own the lowrider. And... they are in this warehouse where I live. It's not very expensive, but it's in a sketchy neighborhood. It's just something that I learned to live with. It's pretty easy to make my work, but it's really hard to keep it. And so it's just, I get a lot of help from people to help me keep it. And now I do have a considerable amount of people who have space and the resources to help me keep them. But there have been lots of things that were destroyed because I couldn't keep them. There have been lots of things that were, like, that car was left in Kansas City. And there's things that I've tried to hang on to. There are other things in museums and in personal collections, things like that. Yes.
Do they have a life? And I'm not talking about the ones that you destroy, but if you had something and you were keeping it and keeping it and keeping it, at some point, is it?
Well, again, it's really about how much maintenance you're able to give to the work. So if I can keep it indoors or at least covered, I'm not opposed to repairing things when they break or whatever, and I've done that a lot. Especially the smaller works that I make are much more fragile than the larger works because there's no structure holding them together. It's just essentially painted dirt is all it is. And so, but I like what happens when I repair them. It's like they get a battle scar, they get a story to tell, and they there's just evidence of that life that has been lived that I think I kind of really appreciate. And also just in general, when you have an object or when you have a person or anything, as it gets older or it gets closer to the end of its life, or its life expectancy, the longer you try to keep that person or the object in the world, the longer it, or the more it begins to sort of lose its dignity. And it will have things propping it up and stuff like that. And that kind of effort that is put forth to sort of keep something in the world is both awesome to me and really pathetic. And I kind of like the fact that it's somewhere in the middle there, and I like it when that happens to my work as well. I don't think it will actually fall apart if I don't let it. Yes?
I was just wondering if that's something you only use apparently unfired clay, if it allows you to continue to work on it, and it never stops.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I can change things a lot. I can, if I don't like something that I put there, I can easily break it and rebuild it. If I can build on top of it to some degree, I can glue clay onto it. So it doesn't really behave like fired clay, where you have to stop after it dries. Yeah. Yes.
How did you balance your life? I'm an art teacher, so I'm curious because I'm trying to.
Yeah, I call my job.
How did you get the time? I mean, how much sleep do you have to take?
I did lose a lot of sleep, and it's very difficult to be both an artist and a teacher. And they require completely opposite kinds of skills. And as an artist, you have to be completely selfish and solitary. And as a teacher, you have to be completely generous and giving and understanding. And so I guess I didn't really balance very well at all. You know, I would always get lopsided on one thing or the other, and then try my hardest to catch up. And it was always more work than I could do, and
never enough time.
Yeah, and you're asked to do more jobs than you're really capable of as a human being. But I decided that I could be, like, there were about three jobs that I had to do fairly well, and I decided I could let one of them slide. So it was usually, you know, committee work or whatever that I didn't do so well at. Yes?
When you were introduced, there was a review of your work or a show that was mentioned. That where the reviewer said there was an outpouring of sadness that he reacted to. How do you feel when consider your work that way?
Well, he was talking really specifically about those cellos. And those cellos I had made in 2001, 2000, around that time. And as I said, they came out of like this death, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I was, like, deeply, deeply moved by this death. I didn't know what to do with it. And I was completely sad, and these pieces came out of all that sadness. And so for them to be kind of locked in my little apartment for 10 years and then to be brought out again 10 years later and shown in one show, and for him to kind of come in and get all of that out of them, I mean, it's lousy. It has to be about sadness, but you got to do something, you know, when you're sad. You know, and it's kind of, if it's going to go towards all this work or whatever, then, you know, I think that's a fairly good thing. And I was thankful that he hit it right on the nail, you know, and I didn't have to explain it to him at all. I didn't talk to him or anything. So, but not all my work is that sad, you know. It's got a range.
Okay, am I done?